You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
7 minutes after 12, good afternoon to you. You're at the Midday Report, where you won't miss a thing. You can join our conversations. Tweet me at Stephen Critters or SMS me, as always, 31567 or 31702. We'll get the latest from Lesotho as the Prime Minister's estranged wife is gunned down. Speak to the Public Protector's Office about her state capture preliminary investigation and hear from the Finance Minister. But we start with the announcement from the Minister of Mineral Resources, Musabenze Zwane, that 30% of the country's mines must now be owned by black people. He's announced the new mining charter in Pretoria, saying new prospecting rights must have 50% black control. But the Chamber of Mines has refused to attend that announcement and said last night Zwane had tried to invite them to a meeting scheduled today for just an hour before his announcement and that no process was followed. Zwane made his announcement in Pretoria this morning.
On the element of ownership, the 2017 charter requires that a new prospecting right must have a minimum of 50 plus one black person shareholding, which must include voting rights. A new mining right must have 30% black person's shareholding, with 30% shareholding to be appointed between employees, communities, and entrepreneurs in a specific manner. In demonstrating government's commitment to ensuring that our workers realize decent benefits, we have incorporated measures aimed at addressing their concerns, the most notable being the allocation of 8% shareholding to workers and the separation of workers' shareholding from that of entrepreneurs. Holders of rights are also required to submit a housing and living conditions plan that caters for human dignity and privacy for workers. A 14% shareholding to black entrepreneurs evidences that this instrument of change is serious about new black entrepreneurs. It is designed to encourage new black shareholders in mining and mineral ventures.
That's Musabenze Zwane, the Minister of Mineral Resources, speaking this morning at that announcement. Alan Seckham, the mining editor for the Business Day newspaper. Alan, afternoon to you. Thank you for your time today. How radical is this new charter? How much of a change is it from the previous charters?
Hi, Stephen. I think the ownership levels are the key change in this. It's 50% plus one for black ownership for a prospecting rights holder and 30% for a mining rights holder. I think those are the two key points. Also, there's a line in here that a rights holder has to pay 1% of their annual turnover to the 30% black ownership structure of a mining right. And this comes off the annual turnover line. So it's going to cause a lot of consternation in the mining industry, I think.
We've seen already before the announcement, we saw mining shares losing value significantly. They went down 2% before it was even announced. That was on the JSE this morning. I imagine this then, when you consider the relationship between the Chamber of Mines and the Mineral Resources Ministry, is going to make things more difficult for the industry.
Absolutely. It seems to be completely dysfunctional at the moment. A number of lawyers have already told me that they expect the Chamber or other mining lawyers to take this charter to court almost immediately. There's clearly a lot of unhappiness in the Chamber of Mines about the way this charter has been handled. Roger Baxter, the chief executive of the Chamber, has said on numerous occasions he didn't feel there was enough consultation with the mining sector, which, you know, has to implement these laws. And being a major stakeholder, it does feel a bit neglected, and that this charter is being imposed on it.
In the meantime, it might be a little difficult for the Chamber to negotiate with Musabenze Zwane, considering some of the other situations around him.
There is no more negotiation, not on this charter. The Minister made it very clear today that the button has been pushed, the charter has been gazetted, there is no more time for discussion, now it's time for implementation.
Alan Seckham, thanks very much indeed. Mining editor for the Business Day newspaper. The Chamber of Mines is due to give its full reaction to all of this at 1:30. They've got a press conference scheduled. You'll hear their reaction in the EWN bulletins through the afternoon. A statement from the Transport Ministry in the last hour or so that the taxi strike that brought much of Gauteng to a halt should now be called off after a settlement was reached between the SA National Taxi Council and SA Finance Holdings over the financial terms of the purchase agreements for the minibus taxis. Taxi operators blocked major highways in Gauteng today. Aki Anastasia has been watching today's traffic chaos from the EWN traffic desk. We join him there now. Aki, afternoon to you. How bad was it this morning?
Good afternoon to you, Stephen. Well, it was very, very bad because it was a very clearly coordinated effort that the taxis did, and you know, and the, how they blocked the roads. Early this morning, it started at about 3:30 this morning at the Allendale exit. They blockaded some of the routes, took over, you know, some of the trucks, and literally blockaded those exits with those trucks that they hijacked, and I put in inverted commas. And then what we saw was this coordinated effort. There were like groups of taxis traveling along many routes across Gauteng, but traveling really, really slowly at 5 kilometers an hour, not letting anybody else pass. So they occupied all the lanes and moving really slowly. So they really targeted all those main routes like the R21, the N3 North, the N1 North, parts of Pretoria like the N4, for example, and very cleverly coordinated to really have a maximum impact in this morning's peak hour traffic.
What happens to side routes when the highways are blocked like this?
Yeah, Steve, they get very, very congested as well. And what they did was they also blocked some of those side routes as well. So typically, Santaco really operates between Johannesburg and Pretoria, and their core area is, you know, through Midrand, through Alex, not Alex, at least, but parts of Kempton Park, Tembisa. So they blockaded many of those routes. So anybody else who tried to use alternatives also were affected. And even businesses were affected. You know, some businesses in Midrand, for example, I have a colleague of mine, a friend of mine who works at one of the big companies. They WhatsApped all the employees to say, listen, guys, there's no point in us opening today because nobody can get to work. So they had to be closed. And even the Gautrain suspended their Gautrain buses this morning because their employees couldn't get to work.
Aki, the ministry says the strike is over. We don't have confirmation on that from the taxi industry itself yet. But if the same thing happens again this afternoon, I mean, just before a long weekend, I'd imagine it'll be even worse.
No, absolutely. And this is the one concern many people have. We've been flooded with calls here at the traffic desk asking the exact same question. But, Stephen, I know there's a press conference coming up at 2 o'clock this afternoon, but the picture has changed somewhat. I'm just looking at my heat map as I speak to you right now. And compared to what it looked like an hour and 2 hours ago and even 3 hours ago, the situation seems to be returning back to normal. So the indication and the signs that I'm getting is that this taxi strike has been called off, but we'll have to wait for confirmation by actual Santaco at their conference, which I think happens at 2 o'clock, if I stand to be corrected.
EWN Zaki Anastasio from our traffic desk, do appreciate it. We are expecting some kind of resolution from that announcement at 2 o'clock. In the meantime, EWN's Palani Pakhadi in Kempton Park, he's with a taxi convoy there. Palani, afternoon to you. What's happening there at the moment?
Well, Stephen, we just arrived at the Empress Palace in Kempton Park, where, of course, taxi operators are expected to hear firsthand from their association, Santaco, on the insides of the agreement reached with SA Taxi Finance. I mean, the taxi drivers are still trickling in their numbers, but around 200 of them have already arrived here. And the convoy leading here was just very smooth. I mean, Stephen, they opened the roads for themselves.
Are you able to speak to the taxi drivers? Have they explained why they blocked the highways this morning?
Well, I've spoken to some taxi drivers and they say 15,000 rand is just too much to pay per month. Of course, having listened to Ngwala's show in the morning, where Aravile Gumede laid out on how SA Taxi Finance have been making turnovers over 20% per annum on their loans, bigger than some other banks, and that, of course, that the drivers say it is the main reason for their strike, and they believe that that should be reduced and that they could be able to have a maximum profit, Stephen.
And the convoy at the moment, is it causing much disruption in Kempton Park?
Not really per se that they are causing a bit of disruptions, but as the earlier told me that the earlier destruction was just to make a statement, and that the only way they could be heard was to try bring to a complete halt routing highways, and one could say that they succeeded as thousands couldn't get to work, and businesses, including SA Taxi Finance, of course, were closed for business today, and there were some protest actions, of course, in that area. So a maximum impact, as I guess earlier articulated, but we'll be here, Stephen, to bring you what is the resolutions have been and what Santaco and the drivers are saying about the resolution.
EWN's Palani Pakhadi, thanks very much indeed. On the line from Kempton Park, he's with that taxi convoy. So 2 o'clock, that press conference scheduled at Empress Palace today, expecting a decision from the Santaco, the South African National Taxi Council, on whether or not that strike has been called off. 17 minutes after 12, just before we move on to the Finance Minister, Melusi Gigaba, he's speaking in Tshwane now as well. Just two tweets I've seen from RSA Police Minister, and yes, that means Fikile Mbalula. I thought that'd be worth reading. He said, and he's hashtagged this, thinking beyond factions. He's obviously talking about the ANC's leadership conference in December, but this is from Fikile Mbalula's tweets. He says, if somebody asked, I'll say David Makura will make a good Secretary General for the ANC. Ace Magashule, a definite no. The man will finish what is remaining of our movement. He will kill it in effect. So that is Fikile Mbalula, the police minister, suggesting that the Premier of Gauteng, David Makura, should be the Secretary General of the ANC, and that Ace Magashule in that position would finish the movement. Ace Magashule does occupy the Secretary General position on the slates that have been put forward both by the ANC Youth League and the Umkhonto we Sizwe Military Veterans Association. That story likely to dominate political headlines for the rest of the afternoon.
The Midday Report with Stephen Hortus.
Well, let's go to Tshwane now, where the Finance Minister, Melusi Gigaba, he's just speaking. He's giving the first formal reaction from government to the decision by the Moody's Ratings Agency to downgrade our rating.
...reflected in gross fixed capital formation, expanded by 1% between the quarters, following a 1.7% expansion between the fourth and the third quarters of 2016. Private sector investment rose for the first time in quarter of 2015. Agriculture are among our economy's traditional strengths, and weakness in these sectors in recent years have been among the major drivers of our low growth. Therefore, we are encouraged to see a recovery in agriculture after a long period of drought. The agriculture, forestry, and fishery and fishing sector grew by 22.2% quarter on quarter. The growth was due mainly to higher production of summer grains, oilseeds, and horticulture products as climatic conditions have improved in many parts of the country. Growth in mining and quarry also rebounded to 12.8% quarter to quarter, driven by higher production of gold and other metal ores, including platinum. The improvement in the mining sector in particular can be partly attributed to improved labor relations, which has been one of the most successful outcomes of government's intense engagement with the social partners over the last 2 years.
That is Melusi Gigaba, the Minister of Finance. EWN's Barry Bateman at that announcement. We'll get a full roundup from him in about 15 minutes' time. Give Melusi Gigaba time to finish that statement first.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
23 minutes after 12. Good afternoon. You with the Midday Report, where you won't miss a thing. A ruling in the Constitutional Court this morning that there must now be an investigation into whether Social Development Minister Batabile Dlamini should be held personally liable for the money spent in the social grants payment case. The court has previously strongly criticised her for not playing any role at all in ensuring that her department was able to pay social grants itself so it could stop using the company Cash Paymaster services. EWN's Jenica Lydes was in court this morning. She's in our Joburg studios now. She's been following the case for some time. Cheer afternoon to you. What do judges actually want to happen now?
Good afternoon, Stephen. Well, first of all, the judges have referred the matter back to the parties involved in the case. They've given them an opportunity to agree to a process under 38 of the Superior Courts Act. And this provision gives the court the power to refer any matter requiring further investigation, which the court cannot do itself, back to a referee to resolve these issues. So the parties will then have an opportunity, and they'll have exactly 2 weeks to do so, to discuss the minister's role and responsibility, particularly with regards to her oversight role when it comes to SASA. And Justice Froneman went back to explain this, because the minister placed a lot of the SASA payment debacle on SASA officials and, of course, the department. While the affidavits of SASA CEO Tukuzani Magwaza and the former DG Zane Dangor, they said that the minister established parallel decision-making and communication processes that bypassed SASA. So there are different statements coming here, and the court said that it cannot make an order adverse to the minister based on allegations that are untested in a situation where she hasn't had an opportunity to challenge them. So in something that is quite unusual, the court has given the entire matter back to the parties involved, and we'll be back in court in 2 weeks' time to see how the matter proceeds further.
Do the judges really believe they're going to actually agree on a neutral person to do this?
Well, of course, all the parties are involved, and I think a lot of this is based on the affidavits of the SASA CEO, Zain Dangle, and of course the minister. And as you said, there's Black Sash involved. They brought this application to the Constitutional Court. We also have Freedom Under Law and a number of others who've joined as friends of the court. So all these people actually have to come to some sort of an agreement, which may be difficult. They do say, however, in the judgment, that if the parties cannot come to an agreement, then the court will determine a further action going forward. So they've given them 2 weeks to come to some sort of an agreement, but of course also stipulating that if they cannot agree, the court will then decide on the way forward.
As I understand it, I mean, this is the first time the Constitutional Court is actually considering making a government minister pay for the money used in a court case. Are we entering new legal ground here?
It could be, Stephen, with regards to a minister. But Justice Froneman did make an important point in the beginning of his judgment. He said, in the past, courts have made personal costs orders against persons acting in a representative role. So maybe not a minister, but as we know, the minister represents her department. And he says, why have they done this in the past? Because in common law, the rules for granting personal costs orders were based on conduct that was motivated by malice or amounted to improper conduct. And then he goes into all organs of state must provide effective and accountable governance. People's needs need to be responded to, and cabinet members are responsible for the powers and functions of the executive assigned to them. And we know that this court has been particularly critical of the minister's conduct, and they said that whether she acted in bad faith or not, that particular issue cannot actually be ignored.
EWN's Jenny Kalides, thanks very much indeed.
The Midday Report. Business.
With Stephen Curtis.
The CWN Business is brought to you by FNB Business, introducing the innovative 48-hour cash accelerator investment account. It's more than just banking to FNB. That's why they help. The mining index on the JSE has dropped today. It's down by about 2% at the moment after the release of the new government mining charter. It was released by Mineral Resources Minister Musa Benzizwani, who said the new charter says half of the members of boards of mining companies must be black people and half of those directors must be women. But the Chamber of Mines says no process has been followed to create this charter, and that Zwane tried to co-opt its members into this agreement. They're going to give a full response from 1:30 this afternoon. Vodacom's announced it's appointed a new chairman. It's the former Deputy Minister of Finance, Jabu Molakerti. Molakerti's taking over from Peter Moyo. And the Moody's ratings agency has followed its downgrade of our economy last week by downgrading the Development Bank of South Africa's foreign currency issuer rating. Moody's also says there's a negative outlook for DBSA on its long-term global scale. On the markets at the moment, well, the JSE top 40 down 0.6%. The resources are down, as I said, 2%. Industrials down 0.19% to 69,764. Gold at the moment, $1,257.75 an ounce. Platinum, $927. Oil, $47.18 a barrel. And the currencies, the rand to the euro, 14.34 to the British pound, 16.31 to the American dollar, 12.85 at the moment. More, of course, on the Money Show tonight, between 6 and 8 this evening.
The Midday Report. Stephen's on Twitter at Stephen Grotus.
Well, tweets coming through at the moment, many of them in response to those tweets put out by the sports minister Fikile Mbalula, in which he said that he believed that David Makura would be a very, very good Secretary General for the ANC, and that Ace Magashule would kill the movement already. So lots of people talking about that, and Paul Madonsela saying, what about you, Fikile Mbalula? Talk to Mashabane saying, come on, Stephen, are you surprised? Other people talking about this. Kevin Ashton says, can we switch to Orwellian language? Double plus good, and Ace Magashule would be double plus ungood, is the way he's putting it. Mark Stevetich talking about the conversation relating to the financing of the quantum taxis, says the taxi costs around 800K. Remove insurance and tracker costs, everyone pays that. There's a whole conversation happening around how those are actually funded at the moment. We'll know all about it from the announcement by the taxi industry, the South African National Taxi Council, at 2 o'clock this afternoon.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
24 minutes to 1 o'clock. Good afternoon to you. You with the Midday Report, where you won't miss a thing. Don't forget, you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. And of course, you can go to 702 and capetalk.co.za to listen back to any of the interviews that we've done on the program. In Lesotho, Tom Tabane is about to be inaugurated as Prime Minister just hours after his estranged wife, Dipalelo Tabane, died after being shot in what could be a political killing. EWN's Africa correspondent Jean-Jacques Cornish on the line from Tswane to us now. JJ, afternoon to you. What do we know about who shot Dipalelo Tabane?
Very, very little. She was in a car. They saw a man on the side of the road. He turned a gun on them, fired. The person that was in the car with her is in hospital, but Dipalelo, 58, has died. The police have made no statement. We don't know at all. And we do know that she'd had a quite bitter divorce from Tom Tabane. Well, a separation, in fact. They separated in 2012. They haven't had a formal divorce yet. But when he was Prime Minister previously, between 2012 and 2015, she took a court action to affirm that she was, in fact, the First Lady and not another wife of his. So we don't know how well they got on, but it really is bad news, this, for Lesotho. We'd hoped that there's return to some kind of stability would follow Tom Tabane's victory in the election, his inauguration tomorrow. He has said, and we've mentioned this before, that he's going to fold the army into the police because he doesn't believe the kingdom needs an army. So there's some controversial stuff he's going to do. No indication, though, that the killing was political. But, you know, why else? You know, it's just one of those things. We wait to see. We don't know if it's going to affect tomorrow's inauguration. Certainly, the spokesman, Ronnie Mamwepa, for our deputy president, who has been a mediator in this event, says they would like the ceremony to go ahead tomorrow.
And the deputy president, our deputy president, Cyril Maposa, he's going back to Lesotho tomorrow.
Well, he would go back for that, yes. He's been the African Union and the SADC mediator in this. He spent a lot of time, invested a great deal of effort and time. And, you know, so he would clearly be at that inauguration. I have yet to see whether he's made any statement. I'm sure that he will obviously condemn the killing, but no indication from him whether there's anything more to it.
EWN's Africa correspondent Jean-Jacques Cornish, thank you. 18 minutes to 1 o'clock. Well, in Swan, as you heard about 10 minutes ago, the first formal response from the finance minister, Malusi Gigaba, after the decision by the Moody's ratings agency on Friday to downgrade us to just one notch above junk status. The press conference was due to be heard on Monday, was postponed until today. EWN's Barry Bateman at that press conference. Barry, afternoon to you. What's the minister said so far?
Yeah, good afternoon, Stephen. I think perhaps the most significant point to come out so far is that there was an urgent meeting convened by President Jacob Zuma last night with various ministers and ministers in the economic cluster, where they have discussed the need for urgent intervention to address challenges in the economy. We understand that a full-day meeting has been scheduled for 2 weeks from now with all the relevant, as we know, the stakeholders. So we're looking at various people in the business sector, the people in the government itself, where they're going to come together and come up with a set timelines and an action plan, we're told, in order to address these difficulties that we're facing and to turn the economy around. Gigaba was reflecting on not only that Moody's announcement that you just referred to there, but also the figures from the latest GDP that we're now in a technical recession. What Gigaba did reflect on is that on analysis of the figures that they got from the last quarter of this particular year, from those Stats SA numbers, and the need to focus on certain trends that they identified, need to leverage improved conditions in agriculture. We've just broken out of a drought. There's a need to focus on that particular area to improve the growth there. The need to finalize key policies in government as well. And of course, looking at the issue surrounding credit for businesses. Businesses have complained to government that the current environment is tight, so they're trying to unlock that access to credit to improve growth.
Does he say much about state-owned companies, state-owned enterprises? They are, according to some analyses at least, central to economic growth.
Yeah, right, Stephen. And that was among the concerns raised by the rating agencies when they have raised concerns with the government. So they need, there's two issues to this: policy certainty and, of course, stabilizing the state-owned entities. He spoke specifically about SAA and the need to replace or appoint two new board members there and to bring stability there. Of course, looking at all of the, and of course, Eskom as well. That's another sector that says they need to focus on. These are all areas that have been raised as concerns by business and, of course, the rating agencies.
Melusi Gigaba this week, Barry, you'll have been reporting on some of this. There have been all sorts of claims coming from the Gupta emails around his decision to give the Gupta family citizenship, his appointments to the board of Eskom and Transnet. Has he responded to any of those claims?
Yeah, not in the statement, Stephen, but if trends are where they've been lately when it comes to press conferences involving any of our politicians implicated in the Gupta emails, it'll certainly come up in question time, and that has just started now.
EWN's Barry Bapent, thanks very much indeed.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
Just gone 12:45. An announcement late yesterday from the Office of the Public Protector, Advocate Busisiwe Mkhwebane, that she's going to conduct a preliminary investigation into the latest claims of state capture coming out of those Gupta emails. The emails, published by the Daily Maverick and Amabungani, detail communications between members of the Gupta family and relate to the Finance Minister Melusi Gigaba, the Mineral Resources Minister Musabenze Zwane, Public Service Administration Minister Faith Mutambi, and then several senior or former senior officials at Eskom, Transnet and Denel. Cleopatra Masana is the spokesperson for the Public Protector. She's on the line from Tswane. Cleopatra, good afternoon to you. Welcome back to the Midday Report. What process is the Public Protector going to follow now?
The Public Protector, good afternoon, Stephen, to you and your listeners. The Public Protector will conduct a preliminary investigation in to determine the merits of the allegations and the manner in which the investigation will be conducted following the complaint that she received.
You say in your statement that Advocate Mkhwebane may not be able to conduct a full investigation. Why is that?
Please bear in mind that, as you would know, even with the previous Public Protector, there are issues of capacity constraints that the office has, and that is why we had to go to Parliament last year to request more funding, and we're also going to be doing that in this current financial year as well.
I mean, I appreciate the resource constraints, but does your office not believe that these claims constitute a burning issue? They should be given some form of priority?
For sure, we're giving them a burning issue, but you know, you've got cases that we have that has been sitting with us for more than 5 years. So that is why we're just urging Parliament to say, if you give us more resources, we'll be able to hit the ground running so that we are able to create the balance.
I mean, the claim's going to come, Cleopatra. You'll realise it's a contested space around the Public Protector. Julius Malema said various things about it this week. You don't have to respond to those. But the claim is going to come that the Public Protector is herself captured in some way and is not giving it priority and is trying to delay any kind of investigation.
The Public Protector is not captured by anybody, and the Public Protector is giving this matter urgent attention, and that is why she is going to Parliament to say she needs more resources. And you must understand, if she wasn't doing anything about it, she wouldn't have even gotten into assessing the complaints as they were coming. But one of the things that we're raising in terms of managing the expectation that people might have is to say, look, as a disclaimer, this is what we have. We've got capacity constraints in the investigations that are already running, and the magnitude of what we have to deal with and the complexities of the issues that we have to deal with. So that at the end of the day, people cannot then unfairly accuse the Public Protector if she's sitting on protecting certain individuals whereby she is supposed to and not executing her constitutional mandate.
Okay. I won't hold you to this because I realise it may not be possible to answer, but do you know how long a preliminary investigation into this might take? I mean, how long do preliminary investigations usually take? As I say, I won't hold you to it, Cleopatra.
Look, I cannot say at the moment because, as I say, every complaint that comes, remember, we assess the complaint and look at what the issues are, prepare an investigation plan, and based on that, then we know what resources are required in terms of us to be able to hit the ground running. Hence, it is a preliminary investigation.
Cleopatra Masana, thanks very much indeed. Spokesperson for the Public Protector on the line from Tswane.
The Midday Report with Stephen Hortus.
The Law Society of South Africa says it's found that government departments and state-owned entities are still paying white and Indian advocates more money than they're paying black advocates. Bayat Singh Rangata is the General Secretary of the Black Lawyers Association, also on the line from Tshwane. Bayat Singh, good afternoon to you. Thank you for your time today. How can this still be happening in the year 2017?
Good afternoon, Stephen, and thank you very much for inviting me to your program. It is a reality, yes. I just want to clarify that it's a problem that we're sitting with as black lawyers, that the reality is work is distributed unevenly. That results in unequal payments.
One thing, we've all seen this. I mean, in high-profile cases, the Constitutional Court will be full of white advocates.
Yes, it is. Yes, indeed. That it gives an impression that our counterparts might be the smarter ones, but I don't blame our counterparts. It's about those that are responsible and those that are the biggest consumers of legal services. Our government has got an opportunity to bring us into the arena, and for whatever reason, they find many reasons why not.
Is it the fault of the professions? I mean, obviously, it's the fault of apartheid. I mean, of course. But is it the fault of, I mean, I can't see how it could be the fault of the profession, but is it just that the people who hire advocates are the people who are letting this happen? And, I mean, it goes all the way to the top. President Jacob Zuma, for example, has used mainly white advocates as well. There are plenty of other officials who've done the same.
Yes. I don't see much attribution to the profession. The profession itself is properly regulated. The consumers of the legal services, the government being the biggest consumer, it's got all the opportunity to make sure that the legal profession, all inclusive, are equally attributed or equally divided in terms of giving the work. And that's where the problem is.
I imagine
the problem.
Sorry, go on.
Sorry about that. The problem is we still see that skewed pattern amongst the races, but more alarming between the gender distribution. We still find female lawyers being counsel and attorneys still being the most that are heavily affected.
I imagine if you did the same survey for the corporate sector, by saying you would find the same thing or worse.
Yes, I'm convinced that it's across the board. But then, where is the problem? The problem lies with the distributor. The distributor faces one direction and refuses to see equal patterns. And we as the Black Lawyers Association, we said enough is enough. For what it's worth, we are going to go out of our offices. We are launching into a march, which is going to take place on the 14th of July, where we'll be marching to the union buildings. We have done this on numerous occasions. We have involved the relevant departments. We have engaged with them to say, we are here. We've got the same training. We are equally smart. Give us work. We it's so sad. You know, we've seen so many of our advocates closing offices because they are not getting the support that they need to be getting from our department, our government. People are going back to where they come from because they cannot sustain paying what they're paying at the chambers.
Bayat Singh Rangata, thanks very much indeed. The General Secretary of the Black Lawyers Association.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
5 minutes to 1 o'clock. Good afternoon to you. News this morning that the European Court of Human Rights has ruled that the website Pirate Bay, which allows people to download movies through a peer-to-peer file system, can be held responsible for piracy. In other words, the world's biggest site where people download movies, almost always illegally, or maybe always illegally, has been found to be illegal in Europe. Toby Shapshacks, the editor-in-chief of Stuff magazine. Afternoon to you, Toby. How big is Pirate Bay?
Pirate Bay is huge. I mean, it is the largest way to steal stuff online. Let's be honest about it. They've made a legal argument that Pirate Bay says they're not actually storing the files like Napster did way back when. They just provide a service for other people. They track certain files and who has them and what they're doing. But let's be honest, this is how people steal content online. This is how piracy happens. And it would be inevitable that if this got before any kind of magistrate or any kind of court who said, okay, let's look at this rationally and reasonably, that it isn't really applicable that they use the safe harbor argument, which is, you know, they just store data and they're not actively involved in anything. So, you know, the pirates of the world are going to be distraught, and people are going to have to find yet another place to steal their TV shows and music and movies after a kick-ass torrent, as it was called, was shut down earlier this last year. Not a surprising ruling, but it's certainly going to have major repercussions around the world. You know, the thing, though, that we need to bear in mind is that this is like water. You know, now that people know how to steal stuff online through torrenting, they're going to just find another way to do it. Kick-ass torrents closed down, but very quickly other alternatives sprung up, and Pirate Bay was shut down itself in Sweden. It was closed down, and then they found another way to come online. So bad news for Pirate Bay, bad news for pirates, good news for the copyright holders. But, you know, this is an evolving way of people watching their content, and it's almost certain some alternative is going to explode.
Toby, I mean, you mentioned Napster, and the analogy is almost exactly 100% fit. So Napster, people downloaded music.
Yes.
Now you stream music for 60 rand a month or something. Exactly the same thing is happening with Pirate Bay and Netflix or Showmax or whoever.
Yes, that's another point I wanted to make, which is that when all of this stuff started, there was no alternative to watch things online. Either you had an HBO subscription in the States or you didn't. Now you can pick up HBO as a streaming service. Netflix spends $6 billion a year on making its own content. Showmax has just announced it's making two local South African shows. It's a very different world 15 years later after the big Napster meltdown, where actually you can get the kinds of things you want to watch online. You just have to pay for them, and I'm very willing to pay for them. It's just the vast majority of people aren't. I'm very happy to use Netflix and Showmax. Amazon Prime, for instance, picked up the Top Gear presenters and made their own car show after they left the BBC. This is a great era to live. It is the golden age of television, and it is a way of seeing it all through the internet. So, yes, to some extent, piracy is kind of redundant, because now there is a way to watch it online, and there is a way to watch it online legally, and people should do the right thing.
Toby Shapshak, thanks very much indeed. The editor-in-chief of Stuff magazine on the line from Johannesburg. A couple of tweets coming through. Justice for All says, I feel for black lawyers, but what is to be done when consumers don't want their services, government especially? Can they rarely strike? And Michael Watermeyer just saying, look at who's retaining the white advocates in the Constitutional Court. Government should lead the way with retaining black lawyers. Well, that's it for the Midday Report. I'm taking a long weekend. Clement Munyateta will be with you tomorrow. I'll be back with you on Monday. It's just gone 1 o'clock.